Okay, it's Thursday at 1 o'clock and you are listening to the Heritage Radio Network's Farm Report. Farm Report today is brought to you by White Oak Pastures. White Oak Pastures cattle are raised in a manner that has stood the test of time. It begins with southern sunshine, unpolluted country air, and fertile coastal soil. The cattle are allowed to roam the pastures and graze freely on sweet native grasses all of their lives. White Oak Pastures all-natural grass-fed beef has been available in all of the Whole Foods stores in the Mid-Atlantic states. We hope that you will support their program through your purchase of our beef through one of the Whole Foods stores. For more information, please go to www.whiteoakpastures.com. All right. We are live in studio at Roberta's, 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm here with my good friend, Scott Breedy. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you, Aaron. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you. I must say, Scott, you're looking pretty tan.
Just got back from Florida last week, actually.
Awesome.
It's fun.
Well, welcome back to New York. It's a little chillier here. Although I think if you laid outside on like a bed of foil, you could probably still tan, right?
I wouldn't know. I haven't tried that tactic, but I will next time I don't get a chance to go away.
All right. Well, Scott, we have known each other for a long time. We met at the kitchen in Gramercy Tavern. You were a badass line cook, and I was a young protege looking up to you and your fancy cooking ways. But now you're no longer in the kitchen. Technically, you just started a new business. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure, yeah. I just started a business called Brooklyn Cured that focuses on selling charcuterie made from farm-raised meats. I'm selling right now at the New Amsterdam Market on Sundays, and I hope to have other similar retail outlets until I get a space, which is I think a little bit down the line. But I'll be selling wholesale in the future to some restaurants and shops, and I'm also doing a little bit of consulting for restaurants and butcher shops who want to start their own charcuterie programs. And yeah, I feel like an educational component is a good part of the business. So teaching people how to make these things as well as making them well. And yeah, it's so far it's been great. I'm also offering classes to folks, to the interested parties. Those are happening sporadically, but I have one coming up in the beginning of November. So yeah, it's exciting.
Awesome. That's great. So you didn't grow up in like a family of butchers, right?
I did not grow up in a family of butchers. No, not at all. I did grow up in a family of people who did like to eat very well, and there was always a lot of food present on the table. No butchers at all in the family. There were financial people and bankers and things of this nature, but just growing up in a big Italian family in Bensonhurst.
Brooklyn.
That's what's up. Gave me lots of great associations with food and togetherness, and that's why I've chosen to work in kitchens, and I've chosen to open this business, really.
Cool. So why don't you set the stage a little bit for us? You're a young Scotty Breedy, senior in high school. And now you're the man who sits before me launching a charcuterie business. What were the steps in between? How did you kind of get to where you are today?
What a great question. I laugh because it's like there were no direct steps taken.
It's always the case with young entrepreneurial people doing cool things. You know, you look back on it and you're like,
right,
there wasn't a plan, but...
No,
definitely
not a plan. I think some of my Facebook friends who knew me in high school and in grade school would be shocked to know that I now make sausages and charcuterie for a living.
That you're not selling it like the San Gennaro Festival.
Exactly.
Like, Scotty, we know Italian sausages, right?
Without a doubt. In high school, I don't think I knew what I wanted to do at all, but I studied English literature in Binghamton, New York. Was graduated from there and started a career in editing and publishing. Did that for a few years and decided that it really wasn't setting my life on fire. So I yeah, I decided to try cooking professionally, and I did not go to culinary school. I started out when I was 26, so I literally walked into restaurants that I knew and enjoyed and asked them if they needed help in the kitchen. It's like,
what I did too. I was like, I'll peel carrots in the corner, whatever you want. Please, chef, please.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, and somehow that tactic actually worked out a little bit. The folks over at Enoteca on the Lower East Side gave me a shot. It was like maybe 3 months after they opened, and they were like, yeah, just, I don't know, come to play on Monday. Like, and I was there like 2 days a week while I was in publishing, and already had exposure to really good Italian food, like Italian-American staples, and lots of pork stores in my neighborhood where I grew up. So there were always lots of cured meats around. There were always lots of great cheeses around and olives and things of this nature. And these things were staples of a holiday table or like before dinner, like great antipasti always present at family gatherings. And also like, yeah. So I had this exposure coming in, but then at Enoteca, I think I learned a lot more about Italian salumi that I really hadn't been exposed to in depth before. Things like culatello, which is like the heart of the prosciutto, and like we use that to make sandwiches, and like just the sheer like sweetness and flavor profile of something like that really was like influential. And just, yeah, cooking with these things all the time and tasting them was really great. So I was at Enoteca for a couple of years and became a sous chef there and started developing specials like after many struggles. moved on to Gramercy Tavern and
where we met,
where we did meet. Yes, Ms. Fairbanks. And that was quite a life changing experience. And it took so many twists and turns over the 3.5 years that I was there. And it was, yeah, it was wild. I feel like I grew up in that restaurant as a cook, as a person in some ways, and I've seen other people in that time I was there do that as well. It was so awesome. So I was a line cook there for about 2 years, just cooking some meat, cooking fish, cooking fresh pasta, things that were really just wonderful to cook under Mike Anthony, who the chef of Gramercy Tavern, who's got an amazing palette and just really a bright flavor profile with like very colorful and beautiful food, like that's all like market based. I think his style of food has influenced me a lot in terms of how I put flavors together and how I put food together. And I think it's influenced a lot of people that we worked with, honestly, like the folks over at Maialino like seem to have adopted some of like Mike's flavor profiles and techniques, which is awesome because to see that in an Italian format is just wonderful. But I digress. After cooking at Gramercy for 2 years, I started working on their charcuterie program that Ms. Fairbanks here started up in a nation stage. After 2 years at Gramercy, I was just fiending to do something new. And the charcuterie program was a natural fit because Gramercy had been getting whole animals in, like whole pigs from Flying Pigs Farm and sides of beef from Bev Eggleston at Eco-Friendly Foods. And there was not a whole lot of in-house time. There just wasn't a lot of time devoted to utilizing every part of those animals that we were getting in, and we felt as though we needed someone to devote the time to do that, and that's where the charcuterie program came in.
Just to set the scene a little bit, a whole, you know, we were getting in what I think three pigs a week. Pigs are weighing in around 200 pounds, half a side of beef a week, which is, gosh, I don't even know, like hundreds of pounds. So there's like, you have to think about the tiny walk-in space there and just these whole animals coming in every week and they got to get dealt with. And it was kind of an exciting time, I think, to take a look at those. There was, I think when you took over the program, you know, there was some stuff established, but really had a lot of free rein to just go ahead and try things out. I mean, who did you look to as far as, were there other people in the kitchen that you were learning from, or were you reading books? Or, I mean, charcuterie is one of those ancient arts along with butchery too. So where right. did you pick it up?
What I've found is that for as experienced and as accomplished as a lot of cooks are, not a lot of people have the experience making it, because I feel like the restaurant business is just so tight on every level. Space is tight, time is tight, money is tight. It's an undertaking that I think for a lot of restaurants, they just sort of ignore or have been ignoring, because it just takes time and space and money that are not always present. But at Gramercy, like, I was essentially teaching myself, referring to a few books that are widely known, Michael Ruhlman's Charcuterie, the chapter in Curing in Cooking by Hand by Paul Bertoli, two very influential documents that put me on the right path. And also, like, having discussions with Mike Anthony and Nick Anderer, who was the executive sous chef at the time, just about what was going right, what was going wrong. Like, again, like, none of us really had a lot of experience doing it. And I think the only way that you get proficient at it is through trial and error. And there was a bit of error, but just noticing, I think, what goes wrong anytime I'd made something, and just keeping those things in mind and not repeating them, and like critically thinking about the variables that could make it go right, it was very important to like making things successfully.
Sure. So thinking, you know, I know I definitely felt like Gramercy was one of the best cooking spaces out there. I mean, there was really a kitchen unique for New York. It was a kitchen designed to cook in, where I feel like a lot of spaces in the city are spaces that you kind of make work for a kitchen. So you're doing charcuterie work at Gramercy, tons of space, great products, whole animals, super busy, really easy to kind of find an outlet for all those products. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how whole animal cooking is different at a place like that versus maybe the place you were at after Gramercy a lot too?
Right. There were a lot of resources available. There was a lot of space and a lot of people to do some work. Like, we had in-house butchers, so I didn't really get my hands on doing much butchery there per se. There were always outlets for something. Like, we made head cheese every week that we called a pork terrine for an amuse-bouche, and that, like, people loved it. And it just flew out the door because, like, there were upwards of 200 people a night coming in through the doors, and everyone got this amuse. We're making mortadella utilizing some of the pork fat from some of the fattier pigs that we were getting. There were just outlets for every single part of the animal, and it was like nothing would really sit around for any length of time because of the high volume atmosphere.
Yeah, one of the differences, I mean, from the farmer's perspective, it's obviously ideal to sell a restaurant a whole animal because you don't have to pay, as the farmer, you raise it, you pay the slaughtering fee, you deliver it, but then you're done. And I think one of the big learnings for me and a lot of people is that, you know, for every kind of rack of pork chops, there's like a head and a tail and a feet attached to that. So one of the things I'm kind of always thinking about is, where's all that stuff going? And I know, for example, Heritage, like that's the big game every week. You know, you have all the chef's orders and you have all the pigs and trying to match those pieces together. So from a farmer's perspective, it's like super ideal to be able to sell a restaurant a whole animal, but I think it definitely requires chefs to be a little more creative, and then also to be also their guests to kind of be a little more flexible with trying new things like the head head cheese.
No, absolutely. There has to be an agility in a kitchen, and there also has to be a willingness of the customers to like try some things out that they might not have tried before. And that kind of platform might be more present at a place like Gramercy Tavern that's established, rather than like maybe a smaller neighborhood restaurant. But yeah, you're totally right. There are lots of excess like heads out there and jowls. And I think just in the last couple of years, like there's been more of a movement to try to utilize those things. So I think more restaurants are getting into that. And
so we're going to talk a little bit more about doing it in a small format and talk here then a little bit more what's happening at Brooklyn Cured. You're on the Farm Report, the Heritage Radio Network with Scotty Breedy. We'll be right back.
I was walking down the beach looking for some action. Had my radio set on a rap station. Saw a girl in trouble, a sticky situation. She wanted me to give her mouth to mouth assessment. We are the beach patrol. We are the beach patrol. We were cruising down the beach, checking out the action. Had my radio rocking to a heavy metal station. Putting on some shades, trying to catch some rays. When I caught the lifeguard messing with my face. We are the beach patrol. You'll be 6 feet deep if you touch my girlfriend. You know this homeboy can lose control. You just don't mess with him.
And you're back on the Farm Report, the Heritage Radio Network. We are in Bushwick, Brooklyn, at the back of Roberta's. I'm here with Scott Breedy of Brooklyn Cured, talking about making charcuterie. So, Scott, right before the break, we were talking a little bit about the difference in working with whole animals at a smaller restaurant, kind of making our way through your journey as a young man. why don't you tell us, you moved from Gramercy, you became the head chef at a new restaurant in Brooklyn called Lot 2. Tell us a little bit about putting a menu together there and kind of your struggles or your successes kind of working with farmers or not.
Sure. Yeah, going into that. That project, opening that restaurant last summer, we had every intention of sourcing our meat from farmers, and I had all these relationships with farmers from Gramercy, and we thought it would be like a slam dunk, but there were some difficulties. At the time, last summer, it was in the beginning of the summer that we opened, and I was talking to Bev Eggleston about using his pork over at Lot 2, like some pork shoulder for a fennel sausage, and getting some pig heads for a head cheese for the menu. And I remember us having a 2 hour long phone conversation in the restaurant before we opened. And at the time he was telling me that, now this is pretty anecdotal, but I think it's pretty emblematic of how things were and are changing. He told me that he didn't deliver to restaurants in Brooklyn. And this was like last summer. So it was the beginning of the summer 2009. And obviously that's changed now. He's over at Fatty Q. He's over at Marlowe and Daughters. And I'm sure there are other places that he delivers to. But so over the last like year only, when I was a chef at Lot 2, he said that like he wouldn't be able to deliver pork to us.
Sure, because there was no market. Yeah, and as a farmer to come all the way out, you know, it's an extra hour and a half on your day to deliver one pork shoulder. It's just kind of, it's tough.
Right, absolutely. And I totally understood his perspective, but I remember telling him that within a year, at least, this is going to blow up. I remember having the conversation we had was that, like, Bev, Brooklyn is the next frontier. And, like, I mean, I wasn't, like, yeah, it was pretty predictive. Like all the signs were there with all the new restaurants opening in Brooklyn over the last couple of years. And I remember like making a case for Brooklyn as like a place that he has to be, a place where I think he would be contextually like supported without a doubt. And I think he's found that to be the case. But at the time, it was difficult to source meat, to get people to come to Sunset Park, especially for the volume that we were doing, which was not very high at all. It's a small restaurant that's got 40 seats. So in order to make it worth someone's while, you have to be ordering like some amount of volume. So like we weren't ordering whole pigs. I didn't have the space to necessarily store like a carcass like this. And yeah, they're definitely different than Gramercy, where you had all the resources, like virtually unlimited resources available in terms of space and labor and time. So I had to think creatively about making the type of food I wanted to make using certain parts of animals that I wanted to use. And I sourced some pig heads from Basis, who use John Ubaldo's pork. And
that's Basis Farm to Chef. They're like a distribution company, right? They work with farmers in the tri-state area.
Exactly.
As kind of a middleman. You call them and they call the farmers and then the pigs show up.
Yes.
Or the pig heads in this case.
Yeah. So I used them for a while, but it wasn't, their supply was not always reliable. Just, I mean, which is understandable if they're dealing with farmers who have relatively small production facilities. Like, you're not always gonna be able to call up and get exactly what you want. So there were some struggles there. But yeah, I was able to piece some things together and not always source meat from exactly where I wanted to, which was at times troubling. And at times, like, I just had to say, you know what, like, this is just the way it has to be. I can't go chasing down farmers to put their meat on the plate. Like, as much as I would have liked to have that time, the reality is that, like,
you had some other stuff going on. Yeah. You were opening a restaurant.
Yeah, you
well,
know?
I think too that speaks to the volume of supply. I mean, that I know that was one of the things, that was one of the biggest problems up at Flying Pigs, was we had more demand than we had supply, especially when you're looking at rare breed or heritage animals raised on pasture. There's just not a ton of people doing it, and entry into that market from a farming perspective, you know, takes a couple of years. You don't just, it's not a turnkey operation, you know, just show up right. and have a farm. So I think people kind of out there knowing that demand is there. I know, like, we had farmers coming to us up at Flying Pigs, like, hey, how do I get into this business? Is there room to grow? And so I think that energy is good. But the same as Bev, you know, not delivering in Brooklyn a year ago, that stuff is kind of slowly changing. You know, you're definitely like building the momentum.
No, absolutely. Yeah, you could totally see that. And I think with the proliferation of new markets, like, throughout the city in Brooklyn, things like the Brooklyn Flea and New Amsterdam Market, I think that that much more access will be granted. I mean, of course, like, farmers are selling at farmers markets, but not all farmers could come down. And things like Basis, Farm to Chef, are also helpful in terms of distributing. And, like,
not all farmers want to come down.
This is true.
You might find this hard to believe, but some people don't want to come to New York City.
I don't find it hard to believe sometimes. But,
all right. Well, let's talk a little bit more about Brooklyn Cured. So, you know, when did it open? You said that you're selling at the New Amsterdam Market. Tell us a little bit about kind of how you decided to pursue this project and what kind of stuff you're making and then where people can find it.
Sure. It is, Brooklyn Cured is in its very beginning stages. I started it up just under 2 months ago.
Fresh meat.
Very fresh meat. Without a retail space, without a space that's my own. So it's been pretty challenging. I've right now, Selling retail at the New Amsterdam Market every Sunday from 11 to 4 p.m. And I hope to, in the very near future, have other retail outlets as well.
The New Amsterdam Market's located...
It's located at the South Street Seaport at the site of the original Fulton Fish Market.
Yeah, it's a wonderful market. I highly recommend, if you haven't been down to check it out yet this season, you can see Scotty's pretty face and so many other things. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's a pretty great place where lots of... It seems like a place where lots of small businesses, great with great products, are displaying their wares, like the Mass Brothers chocolate, Little Bit Sweets, the People's Pops. Like some really, really great local businesses are just selling there. Some really great farmers as well. So there's produce, there's meat, like. Moose Fun Farm out in New Jersey, like they're raising exclusively Mangalitsa pigs, and this is their first retail outlet as well, and I've been using some of their pork for a couple of my products. So talking about gaining access into a market, these guys are, I think, just started within the last year, and they have some really great pork, and like the market is just bringing the vendors together. It's like, we happened to share like neighboring stands, and I was like, what's up, guys? Like, you have any pork for me to use in this barbecue pork sausage that I'm going to make? And they're like, yeah, sure. Like, so it's like talking about like access to it rather than, you know, delivering anything. You just like sort of like, it's like an exchange. It's like face to face. So I feel like the market is promoting those types of relationships.
That's great. Are you making sausages?
I'm making sausages right now in a commercial kitchen in Carroll Gardens. And yeah, it's USDA inspected and all that good stuff. So I'm not just making it out of my house, even though I don't have it. Which people ask me, and I'm like, no.
No, can't actually do that.
That would be, I guess, awesome, but not really.
So what's on the menu? What are you making?
I have a few fresh sausages that I'm making, a chicken sausage with roasted garlic and white wine, a lamb sausage with black olives and red wine and lemon zest, which is very tangy and delicious, a barbecue pork sausage, which I mentioned, which is a coarsely ground pork sausage that has the flavors of a barbecue rub that I've used in the past, like some pimenton and celery seed and Tabasco. Also making a country pate with some orange zest and port wine that's been very popular at the market. Duck rillette with sweet vermouth and a smoked pork rillette. And also some breakfast links as well. That's my product line for now, but in the very near future, I hope to get a smoker and make some hot dogs and bacon and really delicious smoky meaty treats. Yeah. Yeah. Without
a doubt. So where are you sourcing your meat from now, or where do you want to be sourcing it from, or kind of what's the vision for the future of Brooklyn Cured meat supply?
Yeah, I don't know how deep the vision goes, only because of the access that we're talking about. Like the folks at Hudson Valley Duck Farm are also at the New Amsterdam Market, so I've been talking to them about sourcing duck from them, and that's very close to happening. I think I actually might start using their duck starting this week, which is really great. And I've been using pork from Moose Fun Farm. And in terms of chickens, I've been using Bobo chickens. So I'm like, I feel like in a good place, like, but I'm always open to like new relationships with farmers and trying to really work that out. Like, I'm really trying to source all my meat from local farms, and being so small, it's going to be a challenge, but I feel like the New Amsterdam Market has really given me a platform to do that more quickly than I could have hoped.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Sounds like the place to be.
So far, so good.
Awesome. So, Scotty, tell us a little bit. You mentioned some classes and some other stuff that you have going on through Brooklyn Cured. If people want to learn more about making sausages, how do they get in touch with you? How do they find out more about your stuff?
Sure. I have a website. It's www.brooklyncured.com. And you can check me out there. I have information about classes that I offer to the public. I will be teaching a class on making pâté and rillettes on Wednesday, November 3rd at 8 p.m. at Pinkerton Wine Bar in Williamsburg. It's on Havemeyer and North 6th. And to register for the class, you can email me. My email address is scott@brooklyncure.com, and all of that information is on the website.
Awesome. Well, Scott, it was so great to have you on the show today, learn a little bit about your product, rehash old times in the kitchen. I'm a little sad. I forgot to mention at the beginning of the show, my co-host Heather is road tripping this weekend. So Heather, if you're listening, what's up? I hope you're having a good time, girl. Want to send a big thank you to White Oat Pastures for sponsoring our show today. Tune in next Thursday on the Heritage Farm Report. We'll have Taylor and Dorothy of Good Food Jobs. If you want to find out more about working in this wonderful food industry we've been exploring, they are the girls to talk to. Next week, 1 o'clock, Thursday.